On February 9th of 2004, 21-year-old UMass student Maura Murray drove from her dorm in Amherst, Massachusetts to the White Mountains of New Hampshire.
At approximately 7:27 p.m., Maura spun out her 1996 Saturn on a hairpin turn on Route 112 in North Haverhill. There has never been a credible sighting of Maura since.
Maura is 5'7" tall. She weighs 120 pounds, and she has brown hair and hazel eyes.
If you have any information regarding Maura's disappearance, please submit it to us,
the Murray family, at mauramurrayfamilydirect@gmail.com,
or the New Hampshire State Police Cold Case Unit.
This is Missing Maura Murray. Welcome back to Missing Maura Murray. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
You know, I'm doing pretty well, Tim. How are you today?
Good. Glad to hear. I am doing well as well, Lance. And what we have for the next two episodes of Missing Maura Murray is a long one with Tara, MZ Gags, and we're going to break it up into two parts. We had Tara on a few episodes ago. She's really analytical and has saved a lot of information, screenshots, and is really a great person to bounce some ideas off of.
Yeah, she really is a shining example of being, you know, what we keep calling a responsible citizen detective, someone who is very organized with their material and someone who is respectful in, you know, the interactions that go on in the community here. And she can come back on the show anytime she wants. Every time we talk to her, an hour goes by, sometimes longer. She gives us information after the interview that is just as good, but it's always very useful information, and sometimes might not be relevant to the particular topic that we're talking about during the interview, which just shows like she doesn't have a tendency to veer off course. And that's the case even with her investigations. She's very detailed, very methodical, and always a delight to talk to.
Yeah, just very organized. And so we talk a lot about Bill Rausch in this episode, and we kind of come up with some questions to ask Bill. And since we've recorded this, which was a few weeks ago, Bill has become more or at least appearing more helpful online in the hopes of tracking down his flight information for when he got emergency leave. I believe it's a DA-31 form that he is looking to try to track down. And so I wanted to say, please do not harass him about this. He has said on Twitter just recently that he will be trying to track this down. If anyone has any way to track that down, you know, you could probably tweet him or you can email us, so we could potentially get that over to him if he's at a loss at how to do that. But I really think that's helpful. And Lance, the whole point of this is to rule him out, essentially, right? I mean, we're coming up to these questions. He's in the community. We're grateful enough to have him in the community now after a lot of years. And we have the chance to ask him questions. And so I'm not using that against him. I'm saying this is a great thing that he's here now. And so we want to ask him these questions. We want to get these questions to him. Maybe he's got answers and can help clear some things up for everybody.
Yeah, I think you said it when you mentioned how this isn't any sort of attack on him. It's not anything that any accusations are being thrown around. I want to be clear on that as well. And I also want to be clear on the fact that he doesn't owe us anything, just like the police don't owe us anything. So any information that he gives, he's doing simply out of his own free will. And without any subpoenas or anything like that, he's giving it to a community of people who are interested and determined to find out what happened to his girlfriend back in 2004. He doesn't have any obligation to even speak out. I'm going to add on top of that. He doesn't need to be on Twitter. He doesn't need to be vocal with anybody. He can run his own investigation, communicate with law enforcement, and look for her on his own time without talking to anybody. So it is very fortunate that this is happening right now, and a lot of it is due to the work that someone like MZ Gags has put into this.
Right. So I hope this episode and the second part is they're taken well. So I want to remind everyone out there, no harassment. Please be nice to each other. Be polite. Keep talking about Mora and about the case, but be polite and respectful to each other. It is very important. Okay, everybody. Thank you very much. Hope you enjoy these two episodes with Tara from North of the Border. Thanks a lot. Welcome back to the podcast, Tara, Ms. Gags. How's it going today?
Hey, guys. Not too bad. How are you?
We couldn't be better. It's so good to have you back. Thank you for taking the time to join us again. The last time we spoke, you had so much information that we weren't expecting. I mean, we were expecting you to come with information and be detailed, but you have just a wealth of information. And before we knew it, we had almost like touched that hour mark, and we decided that we needed to do a second episode with you. So welcome back. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I appreciate it. Yeah, I've been pretty hardcore into the Mora Murray case for the last couple of months. I mean, I've been an active participant for a couple years, but yeah, I've just been really digging in, I'd say, for the last 2 months. Like, I mean, 4 hours a day, every day minimum. So I'm sure there'll be more info.
Well, good. Yeah, you're doing a great job. You're keeping an organized sort of timeline here, and you've sent us this document that that we've been looking over and going over. So well done on that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, so one of the things that I noticed that I had never picked up on before, because one of the things I was doing is going back through old articles. You know, they often say there's a cold case and then a new detective takes over. I'm not saying that I'm a detective, but they usually start back at the beginning, right? And that's kind of your train of thought lately. You guys are kind of going back to the beginning and let's see what we've missed or kind of glossed over or didn't pick up on. And I found one of those little treasures. I noticed in an article written by Billy Jensen, the Boston Magazine article titled, "Will the Internet Find Mora Murray?" He had mentioned in there that there was an original website that was created to receive tips, getting the word out, etc. And it was created by one of Bill's friends. I was able to determine what that web address was because that wasn't provided in the article. I think I sent you guys the link to kind of back it up. And it was spbowers.com/MoraMissing, which is now a defunct website. And interestingly, after I discovered this information, John Smith tweeted something around July 27th, asking Bill how he knew this Scott P. Bowers. He asked if they were just good friends or acquaintances. He also wanted to know why the original website was deleted and questioned why this particular person named Scott seemed to kind of ghost himself on the internet and delete all of his artwork, kart racing, pictures, etc. So yeah, I found that to be interesting. I'd like to know the relationship between this gentleman and Bill and, you know, if any tips came in the beginning, was this person forwarding to law enforcement?
Yeah, those are great questions. Yeah. And I don't think I never heard that name until you mentioned it. Good work there. And obviously I was familiar with, Billy Jensen's article, but hadn't really looked at it in a while. And so that's great. Exactly to your point, going back and looking at things again with fresh eyes, this is very important. It's an important exercise. Yeah. And I don't think anyone's, you know, accusing anyone of anything weird with this. I think you're just asking questions, and I think that's important.
Yeah. Now, another interesting piece is that John Smith, the OG in this community, he discovered that Scott Bowers was an artist, and he had wondered if Maura could have met Scott through the art gallery that she worked at.
Yeah, that's a connection that isn't so far-fetched if you're trying to, put the two wrote together, not in a relationship sense, but just in, well, how could these two people know each other? And we know Maura worked at the art gallery, and now we know that this Bowers is a is an artist. So, you put those together, and it's not saying that this is totally cohesive. It's just this is the thought process. Yes, very important to go back and revisit old articles. Very important, especially if you're looking at articles written by people like Billy Jensen, who does their research and doesn't just report on something to get the scoop. He did that article, and it was more of a exploration into the psychology of people looking into people online looking into Moore's case. But I'm curious how. Well, I guess you kind of said it. I just want to be clear about it. How did Scott Bowers' name come into 100% accuracy that this is connected to him? How it, where's the where is that connection?
So I'd say two things. First, the initials of or his initials are in the website, SP Bowers. And secondly, John Smith looked into it, and I mean, he's a former PI, so I'd like to think that he knows how to get that kind of information. But also, Bill did comment on John's tweet and had indicated that he was a friend of Bill's, and just kind of left it at that. So there is a confirmation.
Okay, interesting. So then probably not a connection through the art gallery, but who knows? That'd be quite a coincidence, I guess.
For sure. Yeah, and Lance, to your point, when you're talking about Billy's article and the psychology looking into it, sometimes I feel like there's some kind of psychological experiment going on right now with us all involved in the case. Do you guys ever feel that way?
Every single day.
There certainly are elements that sometimes appear like someone is distracting on purpose and almost putting people through an exercise in distraction.
Yeah, at this point, it wouldn't surprise me if it came to light that some government organization who is doing research on how to better solve cold cases invented this whole scenario and directed us in very subtle ways to look into it, and then they took notes, and we were sort of their lab rats, unbeknownst to us. And it comes out later on, and we're like, wow, that makes sense that it was the Department of Homeland Security or something, or the Department of Justice, and we were just this cog in a giant gearworks of an experiment to solve crimes.
One other thing that I found going through some old articles and posts, etc., is I wondered who Bill was driven back to the airport by once he completed his search for Maura. I noticed he made a few calls to an Avis car rental place. I think it's calls 530, 531, and 534. So I was wondering, did he have to rent a car to get back to the airport? And the only reason why I ask is because I feel like he seems to be relatively forthcoming about other names. But on Twitter, he had commented that there was a person, in quotations, that drove him back to the airport. So who was it? So I mean, who knows? I'm just kind of putting together, oh, did he call Avis to put together a car rental to get back to the airport? Because we know his parents had driven up there and picked him up originally. So I guess I just thought in my mind that his parents would have driven him back. But then I saw the car rental and wondered, huh, I wonder who this person is that drove him back.
Right. Well, that's interesting. So the numbers that you're talking about, 530, 531, they are to a Springfield, Massachusetts Avis car rental place.
So how close is Springfield to anything that's important in this case? Do you guys know?
Amherst. It's very close to UMass Amherst. like 20 minutes, maybe half an hour at most away. I think if you're going to rent, if you're in Amherst and you're going to rent a car, you're probably going to do it through Springfield, Mass.
Okay. And then, so I think one of the calls around that time is, is the roaming calls indicate that they were, maybe him and Bob McDonald had gone to Amherst to look through Maura's dorm. So maybe that would make sense, because I think Rob McDonald, the professor, went back on Thursday the 19th. So maybe they were inquiring about the car on the 18th.
Yeah, these calls were on the 19th. And if you look at the phone records, it's the Springfield number is called twice in a row for 2 minutes and a span of 6 minutes apart. And then there are two incoming calls. One is for 1 minute, which I think is just registering the call. And then there's a 3 minute call, which is probably the voicemail of that same phone call. And then that same Springfield number is called back for just a minute. So it's curious to me if that is the number to the Avis rental rental car facility. I'm curious about the length of time that one was on the phone. When it's 2 minutes, 2 minutes, the voicemail's 3 minutes, and then the callback is 1 minute. That's certainly not enough time to rent a car. So maybe, I don't know.
I mean, that could be just
1 minute.
Well, there's a couple of calls here. 1 minute, 2 minutes. I mean, it could be just I need to reserve a car. I'll be down there in a half hour or something.
It could be. I know that the phone records will automatically register 1 minute when the other line is picked up. So a 1 minute call is essentially it stopped ringing and it went to an answering service. That's just how it strikes me. I don't know. I've rented a few cars and I've always called and it's always been well longer than 2 minutes. Unless he is, you're right. Unless he did just call the first time it went to an answering service and then he called back, someone picked up and he said, listen, I'm coming down. Do you have any cars that are available to rent? And then they called him back and spoke for 3 minutes and said, yes, we have a couple of these types of cars. And then, you know, could be that he called back or something. I don't know. Just saying the duration is a little bit, it's very short.
It's short, but there's two calls there. Well, there's three, two of the Avis and two of them are 2 minutes long. So I don't know. I think it's enough time to be like, all right, I'm coming down there. But
yeah,
I want to point out that there are now anyway, Enterprise rent-a-cars in Amherst, Massachusetts. So at least now, I'm not sure when they were there.
Yeah. Right. So when you look it up on the tool that I use is called Spokio. So you can input someone's name, address, telephone number, whatever you have, and it'll give you a history. Like this number was attached to this particular location, and it will give, say, 16 years ago. So I've done that quite a bit with a lot of the phone records and found some interesting stuff.
And this particular number was connected to Avis 16 years ago. Is it also connected to, is that Avis located in a La Quinta hotel?
I don't know. I'm going to have to look that up.
I think if you just simply, I think I did a Google search of Avis car rentals, Springfield, Mass. And what came up was one that was connected to a La Quinta hotel with that number. It makes sense. A lot of people traveling will, you know, the hotels that are close to, like if Springfield is the only place that's close to like an airport or something, they would have some sort of rental car option.
Let me just say that this is the one right near Union Station, the train station too.
Oh, okay. I'm writing this down.
Yeah. Okay. So that makes sense that the rental car place would be at a hotel because people would be traveling on the train. And then if they're staying at the hotel, then they would have a place to rent the car. The way it would work, like near an airport.
Yeah. There is a La Quinta there. Yep.
And it makes sense because I know the professor said that his wife had gone back on the Monday. So then he would have been there without a car, assuming she drove the car home.
And I'm not saying when I brought up the La Quinta, I'm not saying that I think that anybody was staying at the La Quinta. You know, I was just saying for those who are going to look up rental car locations in Springfield, they're going to see that this one is connected to a La Quinta.
For sure. And I hope after our discussion and some of the points that we bring up, I hope that people do dig in a little bit and see what they can find. So yeah, back to Mr. Rob McDonald. So we know that he was Bill's history professor at West Point. We also know that Bill was no longer at West Point as he was stationed in Oklahoma. So apparently they were friends outside of school. Bill's communicated that online. And Bill and Maura had met the McDonald's on a few occasions. This is what strikes me as odd. There's two calls during the billing cycle provided from January 23rd to February 22nd. Call number 347 is on February the 9th at 7 p.m. for 34 minutes. The second call is number 506 on February 13th at 2:28 p.m. for 20 minutes. So the reason why these calls are peculiar to me is because in the entire billing cycle, Bill only calls Professor McDonald two times. So the first time on February 9th, Bill was talking to the professor for 34 minutes from 7 to 7:34. And this is, I guess, right around the time of Maura's disappearance, right? On the 9th.
Yeah, it is. I think the cell phone records are central time. So if that says 7 p.m. to 7:34, it was really 8 p.m. to 8:34 on the East Coast. So that means Maura had just disappeared.
Like literally just disappeared.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just odd timing. And then the other thing that's odd is, so Bill has stated a few times online that he didn't find out that Maura was missing until February the 10th around supper time. He recalls receiving a phone call from Fred Murray while he was eating dinner, advising that Maura had her car was in an accident and she was missing. So I just think it's odd to get the call or for him to call on the 9th, the day this happened, but the 10th is when he found out. You see where I'm going with that?
I'm not entirely clear.
I just think it's weird. Like so we know that Rob and Christine went to go help Bill, but where's the call that Bill has made calling Professor McDonald asking him to come and help?
Yes, because that long call was on the 9th, and we know that Bob and Bill and Bob's wife were all there together. So at some point there had to have been a call made, is what you're saying. So if he had just talked to him the night before and then he finds out the next day or the next evening and Bob and his wife are able to make it to New Hampshire, then where is that call?
And they said they made it in late Friday night, or it says late Friday. And this is from an email that Professor Bob McDonald, obviously this is a professor of Bill Rausch's from West Point, and they helped in the search. And this is from an email exchange that he and James Renner had. And he says, I was with Bill for all that time. My wife and I arrived late Friday and checked into the Wells River Motel, which is where everyone was staying. If my memory serves correct, not 100% certainty, given that 14 years at the time of that writing had passed. My wife drove home on Monday. It was a three-day weekend, but I was able to get colleagues to cover my classes and didn't head home until, I think, Wednesday, the last day Bill and I drove to UMass and met with campus police. Afterwards, he drove me to Springfield, where I rented a car and drove home. Okay, so that makes some sense that they would speak to campus police. Now, the 13th, so if Monday is a 9th, 10th is a Tuesday, 11th, 12th, 13th, what's Friday? I mean, it's Friday the 13th. Okay, so you're right. So then there should be a call in there saying, all right, Bob, like whatever we talked about that first time, I don't know, but you know, Maura is missing now. We need, you know, I would love your help, or Bob maybe reached out to him. The one thing about the phone records is you can't see incoming calls. So this could have been an incoming call to Bill from Bob. And also we don't have landline records, of course. So there's no telling if those calls were made that way.
Right. And I don't know if there was any talk about whether Bob sort of vouched for Bill so Bill could get his leave. So maybe what I'm saying is Bill calls from a landline and explains the whole situation, and Bob agrees to help, and maybe Bob, just with his position, says, you know, if you need me, I can say, you know, I'm gonna be with Bill. You know, this is all legit. Maybe I can vouch for you. You know, maybe that went down and it went down over a landline exchange.
Yeah, that's certainly possible. Although I do, upon looking at his phone records, there's quite a few calls and not a lot of breaks for that to happen. It's certainly possible.
Yes, you're saying that he's used his cell phone so much in those days that when would he have, or why would he have changed to use a landline for some reason? Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I wonder what he used to call his superiors.
Yeah.
Well, there's definitely some calls to Lawton in those days.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so I think it could be in those.
Yeah, I don't want to get into names and who I've discovered are associated with certain numbers. I think people can do that on their own. But yeah, he definitely made a lot of calls. And I mean, he got emergency leave in record time, from my understanding. Any research I've done on obtaining emergency leave, it sounds like, you know, usually it's not that quick of a process. So I think that strikes the community as odd, some in the community as odd. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I have no experience on that. Yeah, I know that I know what he said about it. That's basically all I know. But it sounded like, from what he said, that it was just a couple of phone calls that he made. He made one to like his boss, and forgive me if I'm getting the titles wrong. But and then he and that guy said, it doesn't sound like you're going to be able to get emergency leave. And then Bill asked to talk to his commander, and then he called him and actually was able to sort of tell him and explain to him the situation, and was granted the leave that way. And then apparently there was a signature that was made somewhere. So I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, especially because they weren't married, right?
Right. They weren't even engaged. They were engaged to be engaged. All we know is what we've been told, and just the research that we've done with how one goes about obtaining leave from the military. And he did it really quickly, and it's impressive how quickly he did it. I believe he said that when he spoke to the highest ranking officer, that person ended up calling him back, right? And told him, and so he was sort of like, you know, well, let me think through everything and I'll call you back. And he called him back and said that he was granted the leave. So maybe it was just a slow time there and they didn't need him or something. I don't know. But from everything that we've looked into, it's really difficult to get leave, especially if there's no actual emergency.
It's not like she was in the hospital or, you know, we like you said, we didn't even know that she was really missing, because initially the police thought it was a DUI walkaway, right?
So she was technically unaccounted for at that point, but that was before 24 hours, so she's not technically a missing person.
Right. Yeah, it just seems odd to me. It stands out.
And Bill found out through Fred.
Yeah, so right. That's what he said. He said that I did ask him on Twitter, that crazy long weekend in July when everything exploded on Twitter for those 48 hours. I did ask him who he found out from, and he said that he found out from Fred. And then since then, there's a few statements of his that have been compiled online. I think it's by Falk or Finn. My apologies for if I don't have that right. But yeah, some of his statements have been compiled, and that's what he said, that he found out at supper time, via phone call from Fred. Now, when you look on, Reddit, and you go back, there are, I won't name names. Everybody can look into this themselves, but a couple years ago, someone had said, that they were told that Bill found out from Kathleen, Mara's sister. So I'm not sure. I mean, I guess you just got to take Bill's word for it, but I wonder why the conflicting statement.
Yeah, so that one, I'm sorry, I guess so it was posted on Reddit, but that was from someone from Bill originally, or from
just from a poster from 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But where did that person? Where did that person go? Yeah.
I don't know that. Okay.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know. It's hard to say when you don't know where they heard it from, because if it's Bill having a different story, that's probably more interesting. You know, and maybe it's just a memory, you know, a faulty memory after all these years.
Yeah. And I mean, it has been a long time, so certainly that's possible as well.
But I do think it's fair to ask these questions. And again, want to point out, no one's accusing anyone of anything. No one's harassing anyone. That is not something that we choose to do or partake in.
Absolutely agree. These are just questions that I've written down. I have a whole notebook since I've been, you know, digging in. And I have lots of questions. This is just where I started.
Great.
Another phone records related question that I have has it been confirmed that Maura did not have roaming charges on her phone? Because there aren't any showing on her bill.
I am unclear on this detail.
No, it has. Your question is, has it been confirmed that she did not have roaming charges?
Right.
No, it has not been confirmed that she did not have roaming charges. So it is entirely possible that she did have roaming charges.
Right. So I just think it's weird that there aren't any on her phone.
Right.
If she left Amherst and the accident happened in Haverhill?
Haverhill, yeah.
Haverhill. Would that not show up?
If what?
Yeah.
So she left UMass and then she's in a different state, right?
Right. So that would show up on your roaming.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we know her last call was at about 4:37, I think. And then did she shut off her phone?
I think that's the speculation, but I'm not really sure either. I'm not, because another thing is that Londonderry ping, right? I don't know how they would have known, or anyone would have been able to triangulate that if Maura's phone was off. Maybe I'm wrong on that. I don't know these details, but.
Yeah, and that's where I was going next. Like, it just, I don't know, something seems odd there to me.
Do the police have the roaming charges?
That's a good question.
There was a page that I think we're all missing, the public anyway is missing, but I know the police have said that they have it. And then I'm not sure if it was put out at a later point. I can't really recall the details there.
Yeah. So I think originally page 9 was missing. And then page 25 of the roaming charges. The only copy that I've ever seen is like someone's taken their phone and taken a picture of their computer. So it's not the same page 25 printout as the other 24 pages. And those are of Bill's roaming charges.
Okay. Interesting.
So, yeah, I don't know. I just think it's interesting that her roaming charges aren't available.
Yeah. And where would that screenshot of or picture of the screen come from, if you don't mind?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I have no idea. I mean, Bill's always said that he is the one that provided them. So my assumption is that it was from Bill, but I don't know for certain.
Okay. And so is that the entire page though that you've seen there, or is that just partial?
It does look like it's the entire page.
Okay.
And then there was some discussion and talk on, excuse me, I think Twitter about, you know, add up the roaming charges and see if they match the total that was given on the bill. And when I added them up, the roaming charges equaled, I think, 132 minutes, and that's what was stated on the bill. So it doesn't appear to have a discrepancy there.